We welcome back to the program our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Hi, Rich. How's it going?
Wonderful, sir. What's going on with you?
Oh, you know, the same old, same old. How goes the Bangor summer?
We're doing well. We're doing well. Look, it's a good thing you weren't on the Cape today. A little wild. A tornado there, apparently.
I feel like I'm pretty cyclone-proof. I think I would have been okay. As a man of the sea, I like to imagine that I would have gone through that. But yes, I saw that that was trending all over social media. It makes you wonder, though, when there's never anything like that in a given region, if it's like that prominent or it's just like, ooh, this is kind of notable. Stretch this out a bit.
Well, today we want to talk about a couple more stories from your wonderful book, your latest book, Buried on the Beaches, Cape Stories for Hooked Hearts and Driftwood Souls, and a couple of stories from the middle of the book today. Let's start with Anaerobic Mind, a very interesting story about genius-level talent and its use or lack thereof.
Right. Anaerobic mud is mud that does not have any air, essentially, to catch through it. So if you had something that was buried in anaerobic mud, and it could be animal form, it wouldn't break down over time. You could dig it up, and once something was exposed to the air, then it would all, like, crumble to bits. But the story is about a genius pianist who was a prodigy, and his family lives in the Cape, and he lives in Boston, where he is trying to figure out the directions of his career and also trying to figure out how to fit in with the world at large, cultivate relationships as someone who is a genius, which I think a lot of people will tell you that they would love to be. But if they were one, they would think after a day or two that it can be quite lonely and pretty alienating, and you don't have a lot of common ground with other people. And that is one of his central issues.
And he also strikes up an interesting relationship with the narrator's daughter, a young woman named Quinn.
The stories in this book, with the exception of the last one, there are only eight, so that's why we're doing the middle two, because they're kind of chunky. They're all first-person stories, because I think that first-person stories are a way for writer and reader to connect. It's kind of like the classic first ever story that was told around some fire in ancient times, where somebody begins by saying, let me tell you a story. So this story is told by this man, this genius, his name is Marzi, by his brother. And his brother is more of a regular guy. And he has this precocious young daughter who has this connection with this genius, this wayward genius that nobody else seems to have. And people are a little bit on their guard with this genius because they think, like, oh, what is he up to? And you wonder if it's going to be one of those stories that you encounter later on the news and you think back retroactively and say, oh, I totally could have seen that bit of inappropriateness coming. And it's nothing like that. It's the two of them going out together to dig in this anaerobic mud. And he's trying to get this record deal, and his father helps set that up for him with this guy who's summering on the Cape, this record executive, and he's at the party. And what this genius pianist is doing, though, is he's basically going all around digging up things. He has dug up things in a different place, and he's converting to being this archaeologist. And his family, save for his niece, doesn't understand what's going on, that what he is actually looking for, what he is literally trying to dig up, is hope to continue on with his life, to hang in with his life in hopes that something better is eventually going to come along for him. And in this moment, something that he's not expecting does come along.
I did appreciate, too, I have to mention, the reference to the classic Creature double feature.
Oh, right, yeah. So Creature double feature, if people are unfamiliar with it, if you have these details in these stories that they're signposts. They orient us in things that are not purely fictional. And because reality, what is out in the world, also infiltrates fiction. And so Creature double feature was this television show in New England, in Boston. It could be like in one city, but then it would be in like the next city, three cities over, that was playing these old movie monster films back to back. So on Saturday morning, instead of watching the Smurfs do their thing, you'd watch Curse of the Werewolf and some Godzilla film. And yeah, that comes up in the story.
I also, and the name came up, the term came up in some of the earlier stories in the book as well. I was pleased to learn about the people known to Cape folk as Googans.
Throughout the stories in this book, you will see people use terminology. Googan is one of those things. Almost everyone in this book will drink Cape Cod beer, and you'll see the slogan invitation in every pint. And people will render the slogan differently, because that's how we are. We don't all get it exactly correct, but you get the sense that these things are permeating the air like so much Cape Cod brine. And that's another way to pull people into a world that immersive, plunged into experience. And the Googan is what an old salt on a place like Cape Cod and Cape Ann, Massachusetts, other Cape, would term that weekend warrior dude who's going out, like, oh, yeah, I'm going to get this bluefin. This is how we do it. And he's out there, and he comes back an hour later to the dock, and his skin is blistered because he didn't prepare himself properly, and he has no fish, and he's cursing, and he's ready to get back to suburbia. That's a good thing.
So as we read through this story, we're talking with Colin Fleming about one of the great stories from Buried on the Beaches, this one, Anaerobic Mud. Can someone who is a genius find happiness, or is it indeed a curse?
I think it certainly starts out as a curse, and the way that the curse is shed is through powering through those alienating limitations and losing those experiences that shackle you, that you realize sometimes that a form of happiness is the bringing of relief. When you found what it is or arrived at a given destination, man's problem is that he is not at the destination yet, and he has not found someone who is on any of his wavelengths save this child. And he might have an infinite number of wavelengths, and he probably does. I think that's the nature of genius. She has this one that they share. They share this frequency. And when he ultimately makes his decision at the end of the story, which nobody seems to understand, he shows up at this party, the record executive is there, he has heard this man's piano playing, and he thinks he's brilliant, and he wants to work with him. And he's dug up this lobster that's perfectly preserved, and he sort of plunks it down in front of all the guests, and they're all into their drinking at that point, and he leaves. He doesn't sign his contract. He's gone off somewhere else. And the only person who understands this and makes total sense to her is his niece. And she has to explain it basically in one sentence, not some dilation on a giant theme, because she exactly gets it to her own father. And her father watches this child grow up right in front of him because of her relationship with this man. And the man realizes that that is going to be the kind of power that will infuse his arm, and he's going back out to, again, in a larger sense, dig up some hope.
The other story we want to talk about from Buried on the Beaches is called Smoked Mackerel Productions, the potential production company for a young guy named Wincher, who has aspirations of being a filmmaker at some point in his life, but in this story is caught up in a summer on the Cape in, well, an interesting love triangle of sorts.
He definitely is. He is a diehard teenage cineast. He's the type of, this is the 1980s, he's the type of kid who would have bicycled every day to rent the videotape and studied everything and read the list that Godard said made the best films, and he would get those top 10 films and make notes, and he has a video camera, and he has his first job, which is the first job that many of us have, probably still have, is pushing the cart at the supermarket and occasionally be on like bagging duty. So he's out in this parking lot on his own, which when you think about it, It's a highly contemplative affair because even now, if that's your job, you can't be on your phone when you're at work. You're going to get reprimanded. You're out there. That's probably the only time in your life without distraction at that age that you're alone with your thoughts. And this woman named Sarah Fim, the word, which means choir of angels, she's a college student. She's a few years older. And she pops down to this store to get some alcohol and everything, and she invites him to a party, which when you're a kid, this is going to be whether you go to that party, that decision, you show up on your own with these older kids. That is as profound and large and intimidating and potentially wondrous a rite of passage as you're going to have. That's the same as when your kid is born and when you get married. You're always going to remember that. You're going to tell your spouse about that after you're married, what went on at that. And he has his cousin staying with him that summer. And the cousin ends up pairing up with his lascivious, creatively lascivious young friend. We all knew that person.
Right? Yeah, I was going to say, we all had a Ronnie growing up, didn't we?
Yeah, there was always that guy. Sometimes, like, you go on Facebook, you look him up, and you see, like, what that guy is doing right now, because you thought at the time he was this paragon of wit. He was just the person with the classic one-liner in the locker room, and he would say things that no one dared to say that were just so ribald. And then you look him up later, and it's like, wow, that was the apex. And he has that kind of friend. And the friend is trying to coerce him, lend him the video camera, because there's a misunderstanding over what his intentions are.
Well, yes.
But still, to this twist at the end, and years later, you find out what was on this tape, and you think, like, oh, my goodness, it can't actually be that. It's something quite different. But there is one of those moments, and again, I come back to what you had said that one time with the first story in the book, The K-Path. You said it's a no-judgment kind of thing. There is this extremely erotic, I would say, close to the story. And a lot of times when people have, like, a sex scene or whatever, it's gratuitous. It doesn't need to be there. It's just like, ooh, look, I can sort of titillate you. And I've realized that when I have anything like that, it's always something thematically far beyond that level. There's a tenderness to it. There is a restorative connection aspect that is a completely different slant on an act of physical intimacy. And he witnesses something. He's not part of something, but he witnesses something when he drives home Seraphim after the big party for him that is this giant experience that is going to unlock a lot of things in his adult future.
But in both of these stories, too, our narrators, our protagonists, expect the worst, and it turns out that things were not as bad as they imagined, and I think that's human nature, isn't it?
They lean hard in that direction that they're going to perhaps be the worst. And in one sense, in Smoke Backhoe Productions, the worst is, it's like teenage pop symphony stuff, which is going to be the father of the man stuff later, whereas Marzi in Anaerobic Mud, that's literally a matter of life and death. You have the feeling that on a Tuesday, you could be there. On a Wednesday morning, he might not be there. And people in his life in that story, though they don't articulate a concern over something like that directly, although his sister does compel her brother to go check in on this guy, and they're not particularly close. That phone call would not be a surprise. And in some ways, it's anticipated. And when you're playing for keeps like that, I think that's a very serious thing where we almost don't anticipate the worst because we know the worst. We know it's lurking, and we can't handle it. With this character, this rival character in Smoke Mackerel Productions, yeah, you kind of need to watch out for that guy. If you have a daughter, right, that's the kind of guy you're like, yeah, I want you home by 8 o'clock sharp, and text me when you're on your way. He's that sort of person. But he's harmless in maybe not the father sense, but in the larger sense of, doing any kind of harm. And it's about friendship. It's about all of these kind of things where the character, the main character, Wincher, he ends up really hurting this girl who we haven't talked about, who likes him. And he's just kind of tossing out this throwaway line when he's at work one night. He doesn't know that she likes him, and he devastates her. And that's something that she is always going to tote around with her a very casual comment on an innocent summer is going to be the type of thing that makes a mark on the very bone of your existence, who you are, your life, everything going forward. So it doesn't look like it's maybe playing for the most serious of keeps, but those are the things that often are.
Yeah, it's a wonderful evocation of that time of life and how those scars, those wounds can stick forever, but also a great job of capturing young friendship, male friendship in particular, because when else in your life could a friend's advice, "Don't tell her she smells like big league chew," could actually be valued information?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's the type of thing. And he's giving him the proverbial elbow to the ribs, but he's also saying, look, dude, people have feelings. I can't be open enough with mine, with you, because we're guys, and you're going to react negatively to that and wonder what I'm up to. But hint, hint, read between the words, don't be a dick to this girl. Even though, meanwhile, I'm off over here being a dick to this other person, and can I get your video camera, because I want to film some behind it.
There you go.
The other thing about these stories is, it's not just kids. It's a world where you're seeing the adults learning from the children as well. And I think that's a crucial component. Normally, you maybe have a rite of passage story, and it's just the children. The adults looking in on their kids. The adult is narrating, even Smoke Mackerel Productions. It's Winter as an adult. Mm. We find out later. We find out what his relationship is at that juncture, decades after the fact, with his formerly pervy friend, who's now just like a normal guy. He's an adult when he's telling the story. That's a key distinction. Because if he was a kid telling the story, everything, obviously the language, but the perspective would be completely different. It is an adult man talking about a boy. And there is such a kind of gap between the two of them that there's an impartiality. Because he's not that person anymore. But he's not that person anymore because of what transpired when he ended up going to this party, driving this drunk college girl home, waiting outside her place where she's staying before she beckoned him in simply to witness an aspect of life.
We're talking with Colin Fleming. The wonderful book is called Buried on the Beaches, Cape Stories for Hooked Hearts and Driftwood Souls. Colin, we thank you as always and look forward to another conversation next week at this time.
Okay, sounds good, bud.